My name's Alan Groom.
I'm the Associate Director for Public Services for the Cutter Foundation Central Library. I graduated from here 20 years ago this spring, so it's kind of neat to be back here. What I wanted to talk, this is kind of spur of the moment for me because I came here kind of unexpectedly, so hopefully I captured everything I want to say in this PowerPoint. A lot of people don't know where Cutter is, so I thought I would just put it on a map. This would be Egypt, here's the Nile River, here's the Arabian Gulf, and Doha is this little place here, Cutter's right in there. It's actually a very small country geographically. There's, I think you can drive about an hour and a half from the top, from up here to the border entry to Saudi Arabia right about here. So it gives you an idea, but most of the people would live in this neighborhood in Doha, and there'd be about 1.5 million people, and the whole country itself is about 2 million. But it is predominantly an urban environment. Qatar, being in the Middle East, it's very much a Muslim country. And I put conservative there because it is, on paper, a very conservative country. But it's also a warm, welcoming, hospitable country. It's an absolute monarchy, and the emir and kind of his entourage are very, like, trying to think of how to explain it. Islam itself is a very warm, opening religion. There's a lot of misconceptions about it, and the emir and the royal family are kind of embrace that. There are lots of ultra-conservative ones around, but when you kind of do the whole package together, it's not a problem to be there as a non-Muslim. If anything, it's probably the best place in the world if you're not a Muslim to come visit. It's a very multicultural country. The actual Qatari population is about 250,000. So there's 1.5, 1.7 million expats. And probably 1 million of those would be from Southeast Asia. So Pakistan, Bangladesh, India, Philippines, Thailand, Nepal. Kind of precursor, I'll talk a bit about this later maybe, but That particular bulge of the population is kind of what you would call the worker class. It's a very stratified society. That group is kind of at the low end. They're the road construction guys, the cashiers, that sort of thing. And then there's kind of a middle layer where me as a white Western guy would be, kind of the professional layer. But that's kind of a small group as well. So when you get all these groups together, it's a really multicultural experience. Like there's 8 of us in the Central Library right now. 2 are from Canada. We used to have one from the U.S. One's an Indian lady, but she's got U.K. citizenship. We've got a lady from South Africa and a lady from Australia. So and there's a guy there too. He's from India. So if you're looking for a kind of a multicultural exposure, a real total immersion, this is a really good place to be. I put growing, and in brackets, perhaps too fast. Qatar is a very wealthy country. Absolutely wealthy. Just incredible how much money there is. It has the world's highest per capita income, if it's measured by the income of the Qataris themselves. So basically, if they want it, they can have it. And so I put growing too fast because be nice if they would finish roads before they started another one, or finish that building before they started the one next to it. It's just a constant state of flux, and if they want to move a building, a skyscraper, you tear it down and you move it over 5 feet. I use the word progressive here. Not every part of the Qatari society would I could say that, but the emir and particularly his wife really see education as the way to move the country forward. I couldn't find this quote back, but the emir one time was quoted in the German newspaper saying, oil and gas will not last forever. Education will last forever. It's for a lifetime. I find it very progressive because they don't just talk that. They put an incredible amount of money away to make it available for education, and that's kind of where the Qatar Foundation comes in. So for me, I find it a very visionary approach. Some of the other countries around the Gulf, they don't take that approach, and there's problems, and there will be problems in the future, I think. To kind of end a bit, Qatar, I find it very blended. They're trying to take the best of everything, the best of their traditional culture, and merge it with the modern culture, looking forward to what they need to do to have a bright future. So the Qatar Foundation, which is the place I work for, the emir put aside, well, nobody really knows how much, just an incredible pile of money that they're using the interest off of to fund the Qatar Foundation. So that's the mission, the vision, and there's kind of, well, there's four parts, but those are the three that really make a lot of sense for this presentation. There's education, science and research, community development. The fourth is they're starting to do some commercial activities, and commercial is huge, like a community of 70,000 kind of thing. So in terms of research, the Qatar Science and Technology Park, it hasn't been open that long. It's like an incubator think tank. There's a robotic surgery center in there. There's a Formula One race car engine development place. It's kind of, if you want to have a place to go, they'll fund you to do all the research. The Qatar National Research Fund is a massive pool of funds that are available for academics and people who want to do research. Sidra Medical is just an absolutely humongous project to create a medical research institute. Basically, the money's no problem. Money's no object here. If they need it, they get it. RAND is kind of a think tank. The Faculty of Islamic Studies, it's a grad-level institution for studying Islam. The community development, this is a huge place, particularly the first one, the Reach Out to Asia. They do all sorts of philanthropic things around the world. This is the group that gave money to the southern U.S. for the hurricane relief, but it's mostly focused on India, Pakistan, Nepal, that sort of thing. Lots of grassroots activities. Social Development Center to try and work with the local population on issues. Qatar Diabetes Association. The Doha International Institute is a UN-sponsored thing. Al Jazeera, you've probably heard about. It's the major TV station, and they have like thousands of employees, and it's really something else. Debates and Qatar Debates. The Doha, I get the two mixed up. Qatar Debates, it's on actually BBC. They have 300 million viewers every week. And Al-Shakab, that's the emir's personal horse farm, which is beyond the pale. And in education, we'll get to the library in a second. There's really no indigenous or experience on creating local university-level programs. So there's Qatar University, but it's kind of... I'll reserve judgment. I have one, but I won't tell you. So the Qatar Foundation will say, okay, we need to have a medical program. What's the world's best medical program? And they'll basically buy it and bring it over. So you've got like Cornell Weill, you've got Georgetown doing School of Foreign Service, Virginia Commonwealth of Art, Texas A&M doing a program for engineering, Northwestern is journalism, Carnegie Mellon would be business and computer science. HEC Paris, they've just started doing some programs for executive MBAs. University College of London is coming, I think in September. They're going to do lots of stuff with archaeology, museum studies, library studies, that sort of thing. And then there's also like kind of the primary level too. There's Qatar Academy, Learning Center, Al Noor, which is a center for the blind. So it's a huge, Qatar Foundation has got a huge mandate. And we sit kind of in the middle, which is a central library. We have a mandate to serve that whole community plus the whole community of Doha, of Qatar. So we have a mandate to be research, academic, public, and national library. And the vision is to be the best academic and research library in the Middle East, with typical resources and programs and teaching. This is a picture of our building. which is not even under construction yet. I'm hoping, it was supposed to be announced yesterday, I think, but it's not. It's a Rem Koolhaas design building. He's the guy who did Seattle Public Library, and he's done a whole bunch of other things. That's kind of a, these are all concept drawings, but get an idea. It's kind of, this middle piece here is a huge atrium. And then there's room for 1.2 million books around the edges, and then a big bridge across. So that kind of gives you an idea. And then right in the middle, this piece, this is called the Heritage Library. I think this week it was formally transferred to us, but I don't know for sure because I've been away. But this is a Heritage Library. Kind of see here, you'll be able to walk across the stacks, top of the stacks. The idea is that this is a historical collection. It's a private collection of materials. Basically, a guy was doing a PhD in Arabic studies and couldn't find anything, so he just started buying. It's an absolutely incredible Arabic collection. He's got stuff that's like, you know, 0 BC kind of thing. Basically, if they find it, they will buy it. There's something like 80,000 volumes, 100,000 magazines and all that kind of stuff. Maps and globes. It's just absolutely incredible. So it's placed in the center of the library because that's the foundation of Arabic knowledge. So it's kind of symbolic. It's a bit of a pain that it's in the middle, but you get the idea. It's a lot of... You guys are studying, so you'll know what typical library services are, but... particularly this one, self-checkout, you guys probably know that. I saw a book vending machine in the LRT station this morning. But typical Qatar, they do everything big, otherwise you go home. The book returns, it's not just putting the book in the slot and having it going down the basement and getting sorted. The idea is to have an elevator shaft to the end of each range so that the book will be delivered right to the end of the range where it's supposed to be. And we're having some integration issues, but it will also be that once it's on the cart, the system will know it's on the cart. And down the road, the idea is to have, okay, you walk from one end of the library to the other, and we'll know that we'll be able to track the book across, so they'll be able to do like real-time tracking of books. And it's been done, but not at this scale. So there's a lot of concern about this one. It's kind of neat, but it's also kind of, freaky. And there's a spot in the middle. The architect's a bit of a nut job at sometimes, but he's got they're calling it a sushi bar. So the books, well, you sign them in, you send them in, they'll go into the book drop, and then on the way to the sorter downstairs, it'll go around the sushi bar, so you can go and grab them off if you want. Now, one time he even had a volleyball court in the middle because people don't read anymore, so I got to give them something to do. And he also only had room for four staff. Because if people don't use the library, what do you need staff for? So that's the building. It hasn't been announced, but we still are been told that we'll be opening kind of spring 2013. It's something like a 26-month building window. I don't think they're going to make it because you can't tell from the scale of this, but it's massive. It's 45,000 square meter footprint, and it's something like 5 stories tall from the ground level up. It's just absolutely massive, and it's not just library shelves. Everything is like 1-inch Italian marble and that sort of thing. So imagine how expensive it is. One inch Italian marble as a bookshelf. It's just beyond. So it's kind of neat to be involved in a project, but it's just mind-boggling. So what we're doing is, you can't buy 1.2 million books and have them processed and all that kind of thing. So we're working through a process now of a book tender for 200,000 physical items to get them. They'll be completely shelf ready. I said there's 8 of us right now, so we have to do that. Working on next year, hoping to have 250 online databases available, 500,000 e-books, some journals, serials, mostly electronic. But we have a public library mandate, so we'll also have a public library, a kind of general periodical collection. research databases, and the idea is, like, for online stuff, we'll have a license for Education City or Qatar Foundation, but we will have a mandate to do that for the entire country as well. In theory, there is a national library. In practice, no, it's another one of those I'll reserve judgment for. I'll say it. I think it's shameful that Doha doesn't have anything like that with the amount of money they have. And there is a small public library system too, but it's just not there. And down the road, we will have that mandate. Basically, we could have it already if we were ready to be the national library for the country. And there'd be a couple signature collections. A golf collection, we'll have a special area, a special collection, anything Arabic and English, and basically any language that has anything remotely to do with the Gulf. To kind of balance that heritage collection, we'll have a modern collection so people can do study of the modern Arab experience. We'll also have the Qatar Foundation Archives, the Heritage Library, that's a thing in the middle, and also a children's library. It's very small, but we'll also have a children's library. Just some of the services, instructional programs, literacy, reference, digital commons, collaborative learning spaces, digital media, peer tutoring center, a writing center, an adaptive technology room, children's services, digital repository, mass digitization center, and lots of programs and outreach. So it's a huge mandate. The current project, I don't know if you guys have done any, looked at this one at all, the World Digital Library. Where the Qatar Foundation is a co-sponsor of that with UNESCO and the Library of Congress. So we have a staff person who's done an incredible amount of work with that. We just hosted a Arab regional meeting with this. We got people from all over the Arab and North African world to talk about digitization and putting their cultural treasures online. You may not have heard the British Library one. Her Highness she's really trying to repatriate a lot of the indigenous materials. And what they're going to start with is the British Library has kilometers full of British India office records that we're going to digitize, make available in English and Arabic full text. And the thought is that'll probably be a 10-year project. We're in the scoping phase now with 400,000 British pounds, so it's huge. So we got lots of people coming and going to the British Library at the moment. The book tender, that's to get the 200,000 books. We finally figured out how to get all the stuff together for our ILS. The online database rollouts, a virtual branch. Staffing's a huge one, and that's why I'm here. Strategic planning, the building, there's lots going on. Like I said, there's 8 of us. Right now, there are 12 vacancies, and they actually expired yesterday, but I convinced them to leave the link up for another couple days if you want to go have a peek at them. These positions may, unless you have lots of experience, some of these you may not be okay, you know, may not be qualified for. Next year, it starts to happen where we'll have a lot of entry-level positions. Next year, we'll have 12 more. And in public services, which is my area, we'll have 4 entry-level positions plus a children's librarian. And then we start ramping up. We'll have 60 positions the year after, and by 2013, which is like 2.5 years from now, we'll have 130+, probably closer to 150 positions. And I would think half or more of those will be librarians, probably more like 2/3 will be librarian positions. So just like in my department, to give you an idea, before opening, we'll have 17 entry-level information services, 4 senior positions, a head of research, head of access, educational technology, peer tutoring, writing center. So I put a question mark there because I got some thinking to do whether or not they should be librarians or not. But teen services, head of children's library, head of the Gulf, so it's huge. Just to give you an idea, like information services, I'm trying to create, like in my department, a lot of interdisciplinarity. And we actually, like, so the reference information reserving collections is new. We recently basically took the entire collections department and dumped it into mine. Because it makes a lot of sense to do that. If you're interacting with the people, you should have. It gives you a really good insight in what to buy. So liaison work with community groups, faculty members, web content, publicity. The way we've got it set up, like there's an IT department that will do the hardware, software, and my guys will do all the content. Here's probably some of the stuff you're interested in. And I can't talk about salaries because, well, I could get fired. It's really strange. Really, really strange how they separate things out. I'm not even really supposed to show you this. Because that's supposed to be the QS HR department. But I, to be honest, I don't know what some of the salaries are, too. They really won't tell us. So as we hire people, we kind of nicely ask them on the side, how much are you making, so we can kind of figure it out. I love the holidays. I can never come back here. 20 weeks, 20 days a year, forget it. You get 37 days, plus there's the Eids. So you get 47 days off a year. And in between the two Eids, it's a shortened work week. And like I came here on compassionate leave for 8 days, that's paid. It's just fabulous what they do. Housing, yeah, you were asking about housing before. You would never be able to afford it on your own, so it's supplied. Like my villa is 5,000 US a month, and it's very humble. Really good medical. Like if you move away from Canada, you would lose your medical benefits here. So they just have it's a worldwide medical plan. It's just, you know, you're sick anywhere, you're covered. You have family members, they'll pay for the schooling. A car allowance, mobile is a British term, sorry, cell phone. you get a trip home per year, not just for you, but your entire family. Depending on your home national laws, I assume you guys are all Canadians, which is what I am, but we went non-resident, so our salary is tax-free. And the cost of living tends to be lower than Canada, but not necessarily for everything. Like the truck I have, would, even though it's made in Canada, it's half the price in Canada. So it's kind of strange. And food is food. Oh, I gained 20 pounds. It's really cheap. And then there's some kind of soft benefits too. Like I mentioned at the beginning, there's an exposure to the world. You work with a wide range of peoples. You almost have a total cultural immersion. But having said that, like I don't have to speak Arabic. So don't have that be an impediment to you looking overseas for work. Travel opportunities. Doha is a major transportation hub. Doha and Dubai. A lot of the flights like to go beyond into like India, Thailand, all those really neat places. A lot of them now go through the Middle East. So we've done an awful lot of travel. The fares are really cheap because of it. The lifestyle is fabulous. It's a little bit slower paced, perhaps, than you're used to, but my wife and family, we just love it. In case I have a small bullet on the bottom here, in case some of you have spouses who, I could never work in overseas. Out of Newfoundland is College of North Atlantic Qatar. That's where my wife works. That's what drew us there. It's something like, it's a technical college. It's a state's technical college. There's about 3,000 students. There's like 600 or 700 faculty, and plus all the admin and support. And a lot of people Canadians will work. There's a lot. You actually have to be Canadian to work there. So that's I'm putting a plug in because they brought me over to my house. I have to talk about some cautions, and some of these aren't just necessarily for Qatar, but it could be for other countries as well. We were just shocked when we moved there that we would need our employer's permission to leave the country when we got there. In order to be in the country, you have to be sponsored, and that means you need their permission to do just about anything. Like to leave the country, to get a car, to get a bank account. I had to have, my wife was my sponsor for a while. I had to get her permission to get a driver's license. It's like I said, it's very bureaucratic and not in a good way. There's absolute chaos. So if you can live with, you know, have to get 3 stamps for everything in 4 different offices because it's so bureaucratic, and then the chaos that it results in, you have 40 people trying to get through a one line, you know, the lines are 40 wide, 1 deep. And there is a different attitude towards privacy, as an example. In my daughter's school, they used her marks and as a way of training how to use the online mark tracking system for the school. They brought up everything, her age, her sex, her marks, her where she lived, and they just used that as training. Human rights, be careful about this one. Qatar has not signed on to the there's this declaration about human trafficking and child trafficking, and so the words are there that they support all that, but they don't sign on to some things. Censorship. I'm sure you guys have talked about, you know, the need for censorship, not to have things censored, and intellectual freedom doesn't exist in the Arab world. You just have to live with it. Like, the internet is censored. The other day they censored the National Geographic website because it talked about, they had a program about an oil-free world. So there's just some little things like that. You just gotta say, okay, I'll do what I can to do something different, but safety, nothing to have, you know, guys 5 stories up in their bare feet on hanging off the side of the building installing windows. You know, no scaffolding, or to have, you know, welders not be given safety glasses, that sort of thing. It's getting better, but there's a different ethos about it. Same with pay and benefits. It's often based on your nationality, not on your educational background. So like that huge worker class, $185 US a month, that's all they get. Electrician, carpenter, cash register, gas station clerk. I mean, they do have their housing paid for, but it might be, you know, 50 guys in a room this size. Gender equality and expectations, I should add age things in there too. Like if you're over 60, we can't get you in the country to work. If you have same-sex spouse, forget it, not going to happen. And if you gain one while you're there, you're out, and you'll be kicked out. A friend of mine was just kicked out of the country because the state found a picture of him with some illegal substances that he took 15 years ago. So, but in many ways, you live a good life, you don't do anything stupid, you're fine. I should add, I put things you even need your employer's permission to get a liquor license. I have to have a license to get booze from the one store in town. So if you get over that, there's a fabulous opportunity that I hope I gave you a little bit of taste for. We're really starting a world-class library from scratch. We're developing a national infrastructure for research. We're creating programs to improve literacy, which is a huge problem anywhere in the Middle East, in the Arabian Gulf. If you're interested in kind of really groundbreaking work in that, don't have to come work for me. There's just such an opportunity there. And create innovative approaches to problems. We're not having to like fix things that are broken. We're just starting from scratch. We're able to kind of do things right. And money's not a problem. You want real meaningful work, you want to make a real meaningful difference in a country, you need to come to the Central Library. And there's some coordinates if you want some more information.